In 1995, Chicago experienced the deadliest heat wave ever recorded in United States history. That July, for seven consecutive days, the thermometer hit over 100 degrees, topping out at 106. Midway Airport reported a heat index of 120. But Chicago wasn't made for that kind of heat. Lots of people didn't have air conditioning units, and those who did ran them so often that the power grid began to collapse in certain areas of the city. The human body can withstand extreme heat for about 48 hours, but then problems develop, and the coroner in Chicago reported 465 people died during that heat wave. At least that's what they thought at the time. The sad truth was that in the next days and weeks ahead, the coroner had more people they found that had died. They didn't find those people until the smell of their decaying body came out of their apartment and their homes, because these people had died alone. The Center for Disease Control descended on Chicago to try to figure out what had happened. What could they learn? What could they do differently? And of course, they found the things you would expect them to find. The sick and the elderly were the most vulnerable. But a sociologist named Eric Klinenberg, he refused to accept the easy answers. He spent five more years in the city, five more years looking at the data. And one thing he found surprising was that the neighborhoods that experienced the greatest amount of deaths and those that experienced the fewest deaths had a lot in common. Racial makeup the same, economic makeup very similar, crime statistics similar. What he found, though, is one significant difference between those neighborhoods. One was that the neighborhoods that experienced the least amount of deaths during that heat wave had the most social connection. People looked out for one another and knew one another. And those that experienced the highest number of deaths, well, those areas had been abandoned. Abandoned by businesses, abandoned by service providers, even by abandoned by a lot of the people who had moved away. He came to the conclusion in his report that people died because they were socially disconnected. So get this. People didn't die in Chicago because it was hot. People died because they were socially, relationally disconnected. It's not a stretch at all to say that they died of loneliness. On a more personal level, the comedian Louis C.K. Has this interview he was doing, and he was kind of doing all those things where he was trying to be funny but revealing more of his soul than he probably even realized. And yes, I know that Louis C.K. has apologized for some morally disgusting behavior. But maybe that makes his comments to this in this interview even more poignant. He's doing this riff on why he doesn't like cell phones, and he says this: underneath everything in your life, there's that thing, that empty, forever empty, just that knowledge that it's all for nothing and you're alone. You know what's down there. And sometimes when things clear away, you're not watching anything, you're in your car, and you start going, oh no, here it comes, that I'm alone. You know it starts to visit on you, just the sadness. Life is tremendously sad just by being in it. We live in an age characterized by aloneness. In 1966, the Beatles asked the question in their song Eleanor Rigby, all the lonely people, where do they come from? All the lonely people, where do they belong? And the Bible's answer to the Beatles' question is that all the lonely people come from God, and all the lonely people belong to God. Now, we have to understand that there is a big difference between loneliness and being alone. Being alone is often a good thing. I mean, who among us has not hidden in the bathroom when the in-laws are in town visiting, right? We know that we need our alone time. And at the same time, you can be in a sea of people and feel lonely, a crowd of people and feel lonely because no one there knows you or what you're going through. The U.S. Surgeon General says that loneliness has now become a health risk. 40% of all Americans at any given moment, American adults report that they are lonely. And the more time you spend on social media, the more likely you are to report that you feel lonely. You're 50% more likely to die of a serious illness if you feel lonely. One report said that when it comes to your health, if you have to choose between smoking 15 cigarettes a day and being lonely, well, for the sake of your health, choose the cigarettes. A couple years ago, the Prime Minister of England created a new cabinet-level position, the Minister of Loneliness. And yet I'm not sure that any government official, no matter how caring or how skilled or how well-intentioned, no government program can solve what causes us to experience this. Infertility is lonely. Desperately wanting to have a baby but unable to do so, some people find it very difficult to be around their peers and friends who are getting this blessing of being pregnant and having babies when they so desperately want it but can't have it. And some people begin to isolate themselves and withdraw. Divorce can be lonely. Yes, divorce ends the night after night of arguments, but replaces it often with night after night of silence. One 20-something-year-old guy said that he sits at his desk doing the same thing every day, and he's plagued by thoughts of, why can't I get a date? What's wrong with me? Sometimes it's guilt that can make us lonely and wall us off from people. Back to the heat wave in Chicago. Some of the people that they found days and weeks later after they thought, you know, it was over. Well, a lot of those tended to be men, especially older men, and more than a few were surrounded by notes. In their chair and in the bed that they died, they were surrounded by handwritten notes, notes that they had written to oftentimes their estranged children, apologizing, asking for their forgiveness, asking for them to come visit them, apologizing for the neglect and missing important events in their life. But the saddest thing about it is that those notes went unsent. There was a reconciliation never asked for and never given. Sometimes it's our health that can make us lonely. It's hard enough to deal with a health crisis just in and of itself, but then you start to lose touch with your friends because you're stuck, but your friends' life are going on and you feel more and more alone. Or a parent who has built their life around their children, and now the youngest is moving out, and they fear the quiet. Matthew Murray was a very troubled guy. And in December of 2007, he walked into a mission agency in Colorado Springs. He had a gun with him. He killed two people. Later, he went to a church in the same city and turned the gun on himself and took his own life. He wrote a note. Not a note to family, not a note to friends, but a note to God that they found later in his car. Here's what that note said. Why didn't any changes occur or any love or help come when I accepted you as my Lord and Savior? That's a question that all of us have asked at some point in our life. God, where are you? God, won't you do something? God, do you notice me? Do you care about me? God answers that question in Christmas. Matthew chapter 1. All of this occurred to fulfill the Lord's message through his prophet. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. When we ask the question, where is God? God's answer, Christmas's answer, is that God is with us. General Douglas MacArthur gained his reputation in World War II. But after World War II is over, he was in command of all the U.S. forces in Asia. Headquartered in Tokyo, he was in charge of the United States military during the Korean conflict, when United States troops fought alongside United Nations troops, From 1950 to 1953, MacArthur oversaw the whole operation in Korea. But he did it all from the comfort of Tokyo. The troops on the ground in Korea faced some of the most difficult conditions in modern warfare. The climate was treacherous. The temperatures were well below freezing. The terrain was difficult. They were in the mountains most of the time during that war. MacArthur oversaw all those troops, but from his comfort in Tokyo, in those 3 years, he never one time spent the night on the Korean Peninsula. But instead, he would go from Tokyo to Korea, check it out, fly back to the comfort of his own place. I think we wonder if God's not a little bit like that. Does God just pop into our life and then leave? Is he busy over here doing other things? Does he enjoy the comfort of where he is and then just pops in on our struggles and what we're going through for a little bit and then leaves again? The answer of Christmas is that God is with us. There is power in that little word, with. Does God promise that when we surrender our lives to him and follow him, that we won't go through trials and difficulties and hardships? No. But instead, he promises that we will go through those trials and difficulties and hardships with us. Does God promise when we surrender our life to him that he will answer all the questions that we have about the world we live in or about our own life? No. But he promises something better than answers to questions. He promises his presence. See, at Christmas, we celebrate when God entered into the world. But there's more than that. Jesus wants to enter into your life. But still a question nags at me. Does God know what my life is like? Does he know what it feels like to be alone? At Christmas, we celebrate when Jesus humbled himself and became like us. He took on the appearance of a person. But we oftentimes don't think about what it cost him. When Jesus became like us, when he left heaven, he left home. When he came into this world, he left his father and entered into it alone. At 12 years old, Jesus was in the temple arguing with the Jewish leaders, the religious teachers. He'd gotten separated from his parents, but eventually they tracked him down in the temple. And they asked him, "What are you doing? You're 12 years old." And he told them, "I am in my father's house and I'm about my father's business." But they didn't understand. Jesus understands the loneliness, the feeling misunderstood. His own family thought he was crazy. They were embarrassed of him, tried to shut him up. His brothers were estranged from him. For a long time, they did not believe who he claimed to be. His own community turned against him. The town he grew up in rejected him. The scriptures say the town scoffed at Jesus. They didn't believe him. That's why Jesus said a prophet has honor everywhere except in his own hometown, among his own relatives and his own family. Jesus knew what it was like to be alone. Judas, his best friend, betrayed him. He betrayed him with a kiss, pretending like it was all okay. He sold out his friend Jesus. On the hardest night of Jesus' life, he asked three close friends to stay up with him through the night, but they couldn't. Instead, they fell asleep, and Jesus faced the prospect of death all alone. The next day when he was arrested, all the disciples fled, and Jesus faced the authorities alone. Where were all the people that he had healed? All the people that he had helped? Nowhere to be found. Peter, his buddy, denied him. So there is Jesus, deserted, homeless, rejected, an outcast, forsaken, all alone. Isaiah 53, He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with deepest grief. We turned our backs on him and looked the other way. He was despised and we did not care. Well, at least when Jesus had all these hardships in his life, when his friends had deserted him and denied him, at least his Father was with him. At least his Father's presence always accompanied him. But even that changed on the cross. Matthew 27, at about 3 o'clock, Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you abandoned me?" When Jesus died on the cross for our sins, he died alone. Not only had his friends deserted and denied him, but his own Father turned his back on him, pouring out the judgment of our sin onto Jesus. He was cut off from his Father. But Jesus was abandoned so that you and I will never have to be in this world alone. Jesus endured separation from his Father so that you and I would have an enduring friend who will walk in this life with us, so that you and I will have an enduring friend that promises to never leave us and never forsake us. See, the Christmas stories in the Gospels, the one in the Scriptures, the one inspired by God, not the one the culture tells. Don't get distracted this Christmas season by lights and bling and sound and shiny new objects. Stay focused on Jesus. Jesus and the Gospels. For the Gospels tell us that in Jesus, hope had come to a despairing world. Light had come to a dark world. See, that's what Christmas is about. Emmanuel, God with us. No matter what you face and no matter how you feel, Christmas says to you that you do not face it alone. That's what Christmas means, that you are never alone. I want to introduce you to some friends of mine in this church, people who know the joy and peace that comes from knowing that Jesus is always with them. As you hear their stories, I hope you can find your story there too.
I remember one Christmas, probably the worst, being alone. It was me and alcohol, and that's a really lonely place to be in. So just a lot of pain, a lot of heartache.
There's something about going into a high school where there's 3,000 kids and you'd think, you know, like, how can you be lonely?
In a period of probably 18 months to 2 years, I went from being in a home with four people to being just by myself with the divorce.
The next thing I remember is that here I am by myself in the car on Highway 63, and I've just lost my dad. I don't know what to do.
When you're excited about being parents and finding out you've conceived and then losing a little life, it's debilitating. It's devastating.
My parents went through a divorce when I was in seventh grade. And with that just followed a lot of depression and anxiety.
I was severely depressed over, I think it was shortly after New Year's. It was so bad that I became suicidal to the point where I even was hospitalized for a little bit. And I would say that was definitely my lowest point, where I just felt like I can't do this anymore.
It's a really hard moment to think about. It's just kind of a feeling of like hopelessness.
I think it felt like we were without and other people were with.
Yeah.
And that was, to go to Kelsey said, that's super isolating.
You know, I think sometimes when he takes us to those really low places, that's what awakens us to the idea that we need him and that we need other people so desperately.
In this time of grief and sadness, he was still refining me to be more like him, that he was my sustainer. And it even brought Psalms 3 to mind, specifically of I cry unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. I laid me down and I slept and awaked for the Lord to sustain me. He has been our sustenance during this time. And we're in a very exciting time in our lives. So where we are waiting to meet our little one, wherever they are. But we are being sustained by him and waiting.
The joy and the happiness I'd always felt at Christmas just wasn't there. And I was thinking no one was gonna see my tree, and there wasn't anyone to cook for, because I love to cook for people. That was a particularly lonely Christmas. It also, though, made real in my mind the true meaning of Christmas, because when I started thinking about Emmanuel, God with us, it was, I'm not alone. Even though physically I'm alone, I wasn't truly alone. And it kind of brought home that message.
The term God with us, I feel like it means that even when I feel like no one's on my side and no one could possibly know how I feel, that there is someone out there who is listening, who feels compassion for me, who really worries for me, and who is there to listen.